Next session number 17117, reel 12.
Mr. Coco, reel 12.
That's it. Yes, if any aircraft is in trouble, they're instructed to go or try to make their way to particular designated areas, and one favourite, of course, was the inland sea. And in the inland sea, that is between the islands of, I think, Honshu and the southern island, which I can't remember now, the American submarines were operating, so that if pilots were to ditch in these areas, they would take to the dinghies, the submarines would surface, take the pilots aboard and bring them back. And I must say the whole system was extremely well organized, and to do that right on the Japanese doorstep, I thought, was not only the height of cheek but one of efficiency, and I thought that was great. We did have one unhappy occasion when we were detached. Now and again, as a destroyer, you were detached as a listening post, as it were, between the main fleet and the Japanese mainland. And it's whilst we were on one of these, doing our stint on this, you would be all on your own as a destroyer, the idea being that, of course, you could spot or detect any Japanese suicide aircraft passing over you or near you on the way to the fleet, the main fleet. But it's whilst we were doing our stint on one of these occasions that we had the signal to go to the assistance of a pilot. I think it might have been illustrious he was from. But this chap, he had got himself into trouble. He was in a sea fire. Well, it wasn't his fault, of course, but he could only receive one way on his radio, and though they could hear him, he could not hear his mother carrier, and he had no bearing of his mother carrier, and they could hear this poor laddie running short of fuel and didn't quite know where he was. They couldn't direct him back because they couldn't contact him, and they told us to go into a position where they felt he was last. And we steamed off in this particular direction. I remember we went flat out, and it took us, must take an hour or two to get there, and I'm afraid when we got there we came across and we found him, but I'm afraid that he was face down. He was not in his dinghy. He must have been thrown out of his dinghy. There was this great big yellow inflatable dinghy floating there in the sea of green, because there was a green fluid that used to go over the water, so it would be easily seen. And we got him aboard, and I can remember the doctor we had, and we all gave a hand in the after screen of pumping him up and down, but I'm afraid it was no good. He drowned. And again, that comes the reality of war, whereby, and of course it's the usual thing, as it happened, this laddie was an Irish laddie, a Catholic Irish, and I can remember then immediately who's the senior Catholic in the ship, and it fell upon the shoulders of a particular petty officer to do his stuff, and the gunner's mate provided a 4.7 shell, and the sailmaker got to work and stitched him up, and that was it. He was buried. And of course, when you think that this would now be approaching quite near the end of the war, it's quite bad luck. But having said that, we had no idea it was near the end of the war, because the pilots, Norman Taylor, one of the observers in the Avengers, and his chum, they were not looking forward at all to the final assault on Japan, and for the simple reason, of course, they were like the rest of us. They were quite well aware that if the assault had been carried out in the same way as it had to be carried out on Okinawa, the number of casualties would have been quite ginormous, and there had been a tremendous number of casualties. And indeed, when I think of these people now who say we ought never to have dropped the atomic weapon, the atomic bomb, I cannot disagree more with these people. They are talking in hindsight, and they are talking, in fact, well, quite bluntly, and I put it quite straight, out of the back of their necks. They had no idea of conditions or what the Japanese are capable of doing. Because there's one irrefutable argument against these people who say we should never have dropped the bomb, is the fact that here we were carrying out our stuff as a fleet in our attack, as an air attack, on the Japanese mainland. We were but a small part of that attack. The main attack was carried out by flying fortresses from Guam. These flying fortresses, as we discovered later when I landed in and went ashore in Yokohama and in Tokyo, they had carried out fire raids in Tokyo from the April time all the way through until the time we were attacking in July. And in that time, those fire raids caused far greater number of casualties than were suffered at Hiroshima. And yet the Japanese still did not consider surrender. And they would not consider surrender at all under normal conditions. And it had to take some cataclysmic event, some extraordinary event, and that extraordinary event was the atomic weapon. And that was the only thing which made the emperor say this is something very, very special and made them surrender. And I'm absolutely convinced upon that. Anyway, I'm putting forward a personal opinion there. The fact is that we had no idea of the atomic weapon at all, and I know our pilots were not happy at all. They had to get on with it, because I can remember Norman Taylor a few days after the atomic weapon was dropped, their target was going to be one near the Emperor's Palace, and they knew that that would be particularly well defended, so they were only too well pleased that the atomic weapon fell and the whole thing was called off. But anyway, there it was. The fact is that fleet we had was extremely efficient and extremely well organized, and I can remember being detached from the fleet with the Mighty Mo in the American, and we went with the KG-5 and three destroyers, one of them the Ulysses and ourselves, and we went in to bombard a piano factory south of Tokyo. And I can remember taking up station. We were inland, of course, because our function was to stop these suicide e-boats which might get out to the bigger ships. But we were in sight of the Japanese mainland, and as we were D-Day, sight of France, and we just patrolled up and down. And to seaward, the KG-5 was in position far ahead of the Mighty Mo, and it carried out a shoot, a bombardment, it was efficiency plus this, because she had 10 14-inch guns. And when I think of what happened in the Prince of Wales and the Bismarck, when our guns they jammed and they stopped firing for one reason or another. In this case, the 10 14-inch guns of the KG-5, all the bugs had been cured of these things, and there were five shells going over, and they used a kind of tracer, if you like, on 14-inch, which is unusual, and it was almost like a juggler, with five leaving the gun, five up at the top of the trajectory, and five about to land. So they were firing these 10 alternately, and I'll never forget that. and it was a superb shoot. And we started a fire, and everything was most efficient. And anyway, that was. Then, of course, the atomic bomb was dropped, and I never forget that morning when we had flown off our strike in the morning at dawn action stations, and off they'd gone. And it seemed they no sooner gone, and we then fell out from dawn action stations, and we went down the mess, and we were getting some breakfast together. Mind you, our breakfast is never very glamorous, because in a destroyer you live on herrings in tomato sauce and corned beef and you know, hardships biscuit and all that sort of thing. But you turn on the radio, and it was the shock of our lives to hear the radio come on after the old tune of the World Service came on and then said that a bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima of so many thousand tons, etc. We thought some mistake had been made. We just couldn't believe this. And then, of course, immediately we had all the natter start around the ship, and we had the signal appeared aboard the ship, and the captain had the signal, and it got spread around the ship. And this is how we heard of the atomic weapon. And we thought to ourselves, I know, thank heaven for that. And when the Japanese still refused to surrender, we hadn't got any answer. We thought, oh dear, oh me, what manner of people are they? But when the one fell on Nagasaki, and of course they did decide then to surrender, I must say we were cock-a-hoop.
What do you feel now about having taken part in the Second World War?
Now that's a good question, because as I said to you right at the outset, taking part in the Second World War, I would have had to have taken part in the Second World War, I think, under any circumstance. If I'd remained at school, I would have been called up in the army of the RAF. And in fact, several of my school chums who stayed on were killed, in fact, in the RAF and places. I joined the Navy, as I said to you, because I couldn't see myself getting a credit in Latin, because the old Irish master, great pity. But, I mean, looking back on it, it's something which I would never regret. It was the greatest learning curve, perhaps, of all. It is the learning curve which you don't think too much about at the time, in that we started the Second World War with that, I suppose, feeling, because I was 19 when the war started. And of course, being brash youth, you tend to think, oh well, we're going to cure this man Hitler and etc., and he needs taking down a peg or two, without thinking of the implications all that involves. But having said that, here you look back on it now, and it's something which I'm very, very pleased that I did take part in it. I feel that I've done something, as it were, my small contribution in this, something worthwhile, in that here I could at least, always like Spike Milligan say, as it were, my part in the downfall of Hitler. I forget how he puts it quite. And I can look back on this, because apart from the actual fighting and the banging the bung around, it helps you to get into perspective. You know, a number of things about which, of course, you tend to get a little bit woolly. You fail to face up to things. And it's not until you're frightened and you're hungry, as I was during the war at some times, you know, I'm very, very frightened, that you began to look at things clearly and see them, you know, where loyalties lie and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, here I don't regret ever fighting, and it was a great experience.
Do you mean national loyalties?
Yes, because here I feel this on national loyalties too, that I think here that if you've got a country you think is worth having, it's worth fighting for too.
How accurate do you think your memories are?
My, Now, I like to think, and I, this is one of the things that always worries me a bit, because I've made that mistake on the indefatigable, which I've just mentioned. I like to think it's fairly accurate, and I like to think its accuracy has been honed, if you like, along the way. Honed in this respect. Now, we're talking here of memory, aren't we? We're talking here of memory of events, and let's face it, they are traumatic. Some of them are. I can remember seeing my first dead body in the Prince of Wales and that Bismarck incident, when I came out of the turrets and I was having a cup of soup in the cinema space, and a shell, when one came into our turret, that 8-inch shell, a 15-inch from the Bismarck had landed up in the radar office up on like the boat deck, and it killed several people up there. Now, when it came to clearing up, always the usual thing, the ship, they gave the boys some rum, and these are the 17 and 18 year olds, and these boys were there put in to clear up the mess, you know, under the, they had a petty officers and that with them, older people with them to guide them. But I remember these two boys going past me with a stretcher held in together, as it were, to keep the bits together, you know what I mean, the joints together. So you see, you get this kind of trauma and all the bangs and the scares you have, but when you look back at it and you go to another ship and you talk about it in messes and that sort of thing, you're really counselling yourself. And when in this modern idiom, in the modern today, we have the accent on counselling, I mean, look what happens. We get this in the local paper, you know. I find the most trivial of events occur, and the authorities want to move in a counsellor. What is a counsellor? And I ask myself, a counsellor is a person who just sits and listens, and guides and talks about it, and gives the person who suffered the event the opportunity to speak. And I thought back on this, and I thought that, you know, a lot of the Navy did their own self-counselling, in so much as we moved from one ship to another, and you know, you would meet up with a chappie in a ship, oh, he was in another ship and he knew a chum of yours and he went through such and such event, and you hear that event retold by him in the same way as I told of my experiences to my new shipmates. And if I were wrong at all, the odds were that my new shipmates would pull me up on it and say that did not happen, because I have a chum who was in the Rodney or whatever at the time. You did not go into the attack, you kept, you know what I mean? So that, you see, you always have the counterbalance of truth. And here, if anyone starts, it almost becomes the great Freemasonry, as it were, of experience, in that here, if you try to shoot a lion, someone will know whether you were truthfully there or not, because they would have had a friend who was, you know, there. And what I've, all the things I've said, you know, and the family have asked me about things, and when we meet at our reunions, stories are told and retold and checked and counterbalanced as being fact, or if you try to pull fast ones, right? And I can remember once coming in for a great deal of first of all, catcall and yells and laughter fell around in the Bramham around the X-gun, instead of having guardrails, was what are called, there was a steel plate called a zareba. And a zareba is just like steel plate, about something, all the way around the gun platform. it would extend from there over to there and the gun's in the middle. And it would be that high, right, about waist high. And the only entrances into this would be like through the ladders here. We'd be slot where the ladders came through, people came through. Now, this is true, but I had a great other. In one of our attacks off Bouye, we had a stick of bombs dropped around us, and all that water goes up there has got to drop somewhere. So it's ahead of you around the bows. We had our chief gunner's mate on this particular gun, and they were firing away. And all this water came inboard and fell. And it fell right on the after, and fell like on the quarterdeck, it fell on the aft pom-poms and on the X gun. And it fell so that bang, crashed in on it, so that you've got this enclosed space, like had water suddenly filled up like so deep. And the gun's crew said, "God, we've been hit, we're sinking." Immediately dived in as if they were going to start to swim. But, and of course, the water then drained down through the two ladder apertures, and of course, they're lying on the deck to the guffaws of everybody around. See. Now, when that story, that was not believed. They thought, oh, that's a great, you know, great big leg pull. But you see, what I am saying about it, it is checked and cross-checked. Do you know, this matter of a zareba and the weight of water falling, that sort of thing. So when we're talking about...
In what way is it checked and cross-checked?
Well, of people who were in the ship or from other ships who did... Now, you see, the Urania did not have a zareba. They had guardrails, and they wouldn't believe this could happen.
Yes, that's all right when there are other people still alive or around who were there themselves.
Yes.
But what about in the case... For example, us two, when obviously I wasn't there in the Second World War.
Whether what you've been told is true.
How does one know the veracity
then of that statement and what I'm saying? Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, and of course, this is one of memory. This is what we're talking about, isn't it?
Do you feel that your memories are accurate?
I like to think it is, yes. And here, because I don't. If I feel anything about which I'm not too sure, this is why, at this moment now, I'm going to start to put together that writing with a log to it, the ship's log, because those dates will, you know, fill in the bits on it. And but when I tell you about the things of the Tichelenka and, you know, the suicide aircraft gun and all these things are absolute fact, and that is without dispute.
Because many people feel that the memory does play a trick.
Oh, it does. It does. But there's certain things that come out. It's a very difficult thing, this. Because if you're looking back at ancient history of Beowulf and, you know, the ballads of the minstrels all being passed down, and things can get twisted in history. This is true. But certain facts and certain things must come through. And,
for example, can you distinguish between the type of things which you have been speaking about, which are liable to be absolutely reliable, on the one hand, and on the other hand, other things which you think might not be reliable? Is there one type of thing which you would feel very confident about and another type of thing which you would feel less confident about?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, here, the things I am confident about are those which I personally experience, those which stick in my mind, those which I can hear, close my eyes, and I can hear reproduce in my mind's eye. But what I am not very happy about is, shall we say, which were the cruisers at D-Day? What was the name of that monitor in Bouye? And I know it might have been Erebus, but I'm not sure. You know, that kind of thing. And on that, I'm not so confident. and exact number of, you know, ships which might have taken place a particular operation.
Another criticism which is sometimes made of memory and interviews is that the interviewer can get the person to distort by the way in which he asks the questions.
Yeah.
For example, some people say, well, you could have a minor car collision which somebody has witnessed, which was just a bump, but a policeman doing an interview, well, some biased interviewer who was working to some agenda might manipulate the reply by saying something like, can you describe this smash that you were in? And then they would start to describe things which they didn't see, like broken glass on the roads or blood on the roads, simply because the word smash has been used, or the way in which the question has been couched has caused the person to distort the memory.
Yes, now I think this is a good point. Because you say, because of the agenda. Because he is swayed by a particular desire at a moment, a distinct emotion at the moment, to get a conviction or whatever, he might tilt a little bit one way. We've had a recent case in the local paper here, which I'm always... And you see, throughout my life with our youngsters, we've always had our discussions around the table, and we've always been very strict on them, on particularly coming home from tales from school. Now, come on, what exactly happened? Sort of thing, eh? Now, in that local paper we had recently, local hotel gutted. And they used the same, exactly the same phrase on the local news here, on local hotel gutted, it was down here, when in fact there were three rooms burned out. The hotel was not gutted at all, because for a hotel to be gutted, one would presume that the whole thing is burnt, literally, you know, the whole inside's gone. Yeah.
But do you think in the course of this interview that you have got balance?
Well, I like to think so, because I'm looking at this purely on my own experience at that time, which sticks very, very much in my mind, and they stand out because they are particular events. No, which one can I take amongst them? You see, these ones are, I mentioned about particular convoys in the Bremen and in the Urania, a little, in which nothing really happened. You know, it was the humdrum, like the Battle of the Atlantic was a very, very, well, how may I put it? It was a terrible war to fight, or battle to fight, that, because it's so much boredom, and then bang, bang, it all happens, and you're dead. You're in the water. You know what I mean? It's, and yet it's only that bit you'll remember of going in the water, all the heaving around, and you know. Yeah.
Another thing is that, do you think there's any difference between the way in which you feel about things like losses of comrades and emotional matters now than what you felt